This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It came as a surprise to many in this last election cycle that manufacturing had not disappeared from the United States. Sure, a lot of people who used to be employed in factories no longer have work, but that wasn't just because their jobs were offshored. It was because they were replaced by automation, including robots. We've seen what impact that shift has had on humans, but you may have thought, well, I don't work in a factory, so I'm safe. Not so fast. Robots and automation are poised to migrate their invasion from the blue-collar to the white-collar world. Is your job safe? And if so, for how long? We're going to talk about this invasion of the robots and the future of work in an automated world with two people who have been keeping tabs on all of this. A little over a year ago, we spoke with NC State University's Marshall Brain about the impact of artificial intelligence on the workplace. It was a fun but frightening conversation. Yet despite that, we've invited him back. He is the director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State and founder of the popular website HowStuffWorks.com. He is also the author of The Second Intelligent Species, How Humans Will Become as Irrelevant as Cockroaches. And he joins us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Nice to speak with you again. Good morning.
Hey, how are you today?
I'm great, I think. I still have a job. By the end of the show, we may have automation running this. Who knows? Also with us is Dr. Paul Gagel, Assistant Professor of Economics and Public Policy at UNC Charlotte. He's also a visiting assistant professor at Duke University this semester, which is why he is joining us by phone. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, everybody.
We're going to get you're welcome. We're going to get into some depth here this hour about jobs in a robot economy. But before we get into the specifics, how do the two of you feel about what you see heading our way? Are you feeling good about this? Are you nervous? How should we feel about it? I'll start with the new guest, Dr. Gagel.
Thank you. Frankly, overall, I think I feel very good about this. I think what's going on with robots is in principle fantastic for society. It's not necessarily fantastic at the moment for some people, and it's great for others. But in principle, I think it's a very good thing because what's happening is these robots. Let me backtrack. So, you know, people are worried that some estimates say up to 60% of all American jobs, all jobs in general right now, are at risk of being replaced by some sort of machine in a not-too-distant future. So let me say one thing. Just because you could, in principle, replace a robot with a machine doesn't mean that's actually going to happen. If it does happen, there's usually a reason for it. And the reason why the replacement in the past has happened is because that replacement allows us to do more things for less, right? I mean, it's cheaper. There's a reason why these machines are in place. So in that sense, we're actually creating more with less. To me, the big question we need to think about is not so much about who is it that produces the output. Is it a robot? Is it a human? Is it human? Is it something else? What we need to think about is who gets to eat the output. And I think that's the fundamental thing that scares me, that we really need to think hard about share what we produce.
Yeah, because I want to point out that you are somebody who feels good about this, not because you are a robot scientist, but because you're an economist. And we're going to get into the economics of all this and what it might mean to the economy a little bit later on. Marshall Brain, you are into this robotic thing, but you've also said it's going to make us as irrelevant as cockroaches. So how do you feel about this?
The problem with what's going to happen to all of us, and let's just take truck drivers as an example. There's 1.6 million truck drivers, and those are, in our economy, good jobs. Like, those are great jobs. They pay $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 if you drive for a company like Walmart or UPS or something like that. They have health benefits, fantastic jobs. But it's guaranteed that in one or at most two decades, all 1.6 million of those people, real human beings with real middle-class lives, they're going to all get replaced with self-driving trucks. That's the economic side of it, right? Economically, it will make a ton of sense to throw those 1.6 million real human beings aside. And then the question is, what happens to them? And what we've seen over the last 30 years is that when someone gets cast aside like that, they get, you said I could say anything, but they get screwed, they get reamed, they get, you know, we can go worse.
Their life gets worse. Is what you're
right.
saying, yes.
And there aren't any, there's not like a giant pool of 1.6 million jobs for them to just leap into.
But the good news here is there's no good news.
Well, wait a minute.
We have some time because we had Dr. Missy Cummings from Duke University on the program a couple of months ago. She's the director of the Humans and Autonomy Laboratory there. And she says that driverless vehicles are 20 to 30 years away because the technology that we think is so good right now is not good enough. So if you see this driverless truck coming down the road, you have 20 or 30 years to decide, well, that's not a good career to get into, right?
That doesn't help the 1.6 million who are in it. And I do not think it's going to be 20 or 30 years before, say, UPS says, wow, we can save a ton of money with these self-driving trucks. Elon Musk begs to differ.
Okay. Well, I get it. Well, he has skin in the game, too, Elon Musk.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The New York Times reported recently on two economists who had shifted their thinking on this. Initially, they described a future in which humans came out ahead as automation and technology and robots came on board because those things would actually, they thought, help to create new and better jobs. But then they changed their mind. They put their money on a different winner, robots, because they saw through their own hard data and others that the jobs they predicted would materialize as these things came online would not happen. Did either of you see a future with robots and automation that might have been unsettling at first, but which would have resulted in other jobs increasing or becoming better for the workers? Or do you agree that we should change our minds about that? You're the economist, Dr. Gagel. How unsettling is this going to be?
That's a good point, and I find that is very, in a way, at least for me as an economist, exciting new research that these two authors from MIT have done. And so I agree that there is some, so many of the things that Marshall said I agree with. I am certain that, you know, a lot of jobs will get replaced. And I also agree that the people who currently hold that job and their life depends on it and all of a sudden it's gone, that's extremely traumatic and a huge problem. But that lies at the root of, I don't think that's the robot's fault. I think that lies at the root of how we organize, how I as an economist like to say, split the pot. And so historically, the way this works is that, and I'll get back to your question, you'll see in a minute. Historically, how this worked is essentially we're splitting everything we produce, everything that at the end of the day American people are going to eat or going to consume, is split, broadly speaking, between two groups of people. One group are the workers. If their work is still, you know, of some use to the company or productive for the company, then they will get some share of what's being produced. And the rest goes in profits to the owners of the companies, those who own the robots, those who own the machines, right? And so if we think historically, right, if we think back to, say, maybe 1950 or so, and for a long, long time, the split has been roughly one-third to two-thirds. So about one-third of all the output we produce, all the things that could potentially be consumed, went to profits and owners of companies. And two-thirds went to the workers. This split has changed a little bit over the last 50 years. Sometime in 2016, we were no longer two-thirds, one-third. Two-thirds, one-third. We were more like 40%, 60% now, right? So we went down. The share of income that went to workers went from 66% to, say, 60%. And instead, the share for profits went up to, or the share for company owners went up to 40%. Now, that 6 percentage point decline, it declined by about 3 percentage points until 2000, and then another 3, the second half, just between 2000 and now. So this has accelerated a lot. So And that, I think, has to do with this new research where we see that, you know, on net, there are actually no gains. And the reason where there were gains before is because a lot of what was going on was not a shift, from kind of capital owners to workers, from workers to capital owners, but the much bigger shift was within labor, right? It was certain tasks were all of a sudden obsolete and others became more useful. And so that's why this actually didn't decline very much, but there was a huge reshuffling within labor with the kinds of tasks we do now and with the kinds of tasks we used to do. But it seems to have changed a little bit after 2000, I do agree, and the research that you quoted looks at the period 1990 to 2007, right? So a big part of that is actually that era when things changed and things accelerated.
Okay.
And so that is something that gets us closer to the scenario where, you know, we're entering an economy that's very kind of heavy on machines and low on labor. And then what it comes to is, like, you know, once we end up in the scenario where we have almost no labor, which is the scenario that Marshall thinks is coming soon, the question is, who is entitled to eat what we're producing, right? And I think if we solve that problem, or if we come up with a solution that gives people a claim to the output, regardless of whether they are working or not, one way to do that is to buy ownership claims in companies, for example, then it's not a problem that everything is done by robots. In fact, it's fantastic.
Well, I want to come back to that because you bring up an interesting point here that we have to talk about, but I want to get to it later in the program, and that is, if nobody's working, how do we pay for stuff? And how do you make a living? Because it will change everything. But you see this coming relatively soon, Marshall Brain. You say that these things will be taking our jobs in startling numbers very soon, and it's actually already begun. If you use an ATM, if you use the self-checkout at Home Depot or at the grocery store, or if you use a kiosk at an airport to buy an airline ticket or get your boarding pass, it's already happening.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing that Dr. Gagel is pointing out is that there's this process called the concentration of wealth or inequality or the hollowing out of the middle class or whatever you want to call it, which is the productivity gains that you get from the robots, like the automated trucks that displace all the truck drivers, all that money flows up to the elites or the 1% or whatever you want to call the executive class, instead of being spread around everybody else. And the only thing that's going to solve that problem is a new way of thinking about the economy. And that's what I've been writing about. You know, if you go to marshallbrain.com, that's my latest book is on how do you rethink the whole economic system so that everybody gets to share in all this wealth that's being created by the robot.
Because you're saying that nearly every manufacturing job, nearly every transportation job, many wholesale and retail jobs, nearly every hotel and restaurant job, including cooks and waiters, will go to a robot. And you wrote that in 2011. How much closer to that reality are we in 2017? I have 30 seconds.
Go watch what's happening in the restaurant industry. That's the coolest thing. But vision research is going to make all of this absolutely a done deal within the next few years.
Because robots will be able to see, is what you're saying.
For just like humans, it's coming very fast.
Okay, and the first occupation to be hit by all of this, you say, airline pilots. We'll come back to that in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Raptors Center, presenting Table to Talon at the Farmstead at Brush Harbor, Saturday, April 22nd at 7 p.m., celebrating locally sourced food, music, and drinks at a working farm. Details and tickets at talontotable.com. And Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, featuring the new Outback with EyeSight safety technology that sees problems and initiates action to help avoid trouble. Details at tyndallsubaru.com. Debate over abortion is expected to intensify in the current political climate, and that debate has already started to play out at a local women's reproductive health clinic. frequently the site of protests, those demonstrations have recently become larger and more hostile. And another fight about the nature of the protests has also begun. We're going to focus on both protests and how they intersect with free speech on this program tomorrow at 9.
I'm Tom Asbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the shocking video of a passenger bloodied and dragged off an overbooked United flight lit up social media. Everyone's asking, what rights do airline passengers have? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded public radio 90.7 WFAE.
The automation train is on the track. We can see the headlight brightly in the future, getting brighter and larger as it's coming toward us. Get off the track, for crying out loud.
Woot, woot.
That's right. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHG. I'm Mike Collins. That is Marshall Breen, Director of Engineering. Director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University. He's very excited about this. And Dr. Paul Gagel is also with us, an Assistant Professor of Economics and Public Policy at UNC Charlotte and a visiting professor at Duke University. I mentioned just before the break that the occupation that is going to be most quickly affected, you believe, Marshall Breen, is pilots. And these are big paying jobs for them, although the what they're getting paid today has begun to lessen. They're big paying jobs. These are big white collar jobs that require skill, that require education. And you're telling me that in short order, they won't be needed in the cockpit anymore.
I want to change my answer.
Okay.
Can I do that?
Yes.
All right. The accounting class is about to get, well, should be about to get, not completely eliminated, but here's the two big things. The government could automatically do everybody's taxes, you know, all normal people's taxes, not Donald Trump's taxes, but, you know, the normal folk. They have all the data, and they could do all the taxes.
So those of us who get a W-2 and have a few piddly investments, they already know what we have, and they could just send us a bill or say, here's your refund.
Right. And the only reason it's not happening is because TurboTax plus the accountant lobby are forcing the government to not do that. It could all go away. And if you listen to the HR Block ads right now, they're writing their own obituary because they're saying, look, we have Watson now who will help us do your taxes. So they've already brought the robot in and they're advertising it to make them sound better. But Watson can do your taxes, or the government can do your taxes. And that's like millions of jobs. You know, if you look across the whole spectrum, there and all of that is going to collapse.
This is actually something I want to say about. And so basically, essentially, all of my research in the last 5 years was exactly about pinpointing what it is. You know, like, why is it that it's as you say the accountants or other particular jobs that are easily replaceable. And basically, what the line of research that I've been doing finds, and I'm sure you agree with that, it's what we've been calling jobs that are routine. And routine really means it's something that you can easily write down a recipe, you can write down the steps that it takes, right? And so with tax accountants, I mean, you, of course, you need to understand the tax code, but once conditional on that, it's a few easy steps, and that is easy to program into a computer.
Would the computer be more accurate?
Presumably, yes.
Okay.
At least there's no idiosyncratic mistakes. There might be systematic mistakes if somebody made a mistake with the code. And maybe in the future, computers will write their own code and there will be no more mistakes. That's totally possible. The important point, however, is that it's not that it didn't take a lot of training and studying to learn how to understand the U.S. tax code, right? So that's why we were saying, back in the day or not too long ago, we would say, yeah, if you're high skill, which usually means you have a lot of education, you're safe. And that's not true, right? It depends on what you're skilled at. And if it's something that follows kind of relatively well-defined steps, then those are programmable, regardless of whether it took you a long time to, you know, study the underlying.
So here's what I'm hearing the two of you say. It used to be when we started seeing manufacturing jobs disappear in America, either through automation or through offshoring, we said, well, the solution to this is to get a good education. And a good education will get you a higher-paying, white-collar job, and those jobs aren't going away. But you're saying that they are going to go away, that computers will be able to do these jobs, particularly when they deal with numbers and rules, because rules can be programmed, and computers, that's all they are, is numbers.
Yep, I mean, I fully agree with that, or I agree almost entirely with that statement. But I would say, you said you need a good education. I think the word good becomes more and more important, right? Education, not every type of education is good in the sense that you can't be replaced, right? And so I think we should later talk a little bit about, you know, what it is that we should tell our children to focus. Because I still believe, like you said earlier, Mike, there's still some time. But, you know, things may be accelerating, right? So there's time for us to adjust, but you know, eventually, I agree with Marshall, we're going to get very light on labor and very heavy on machines and robots, and we should think about how we want to organize our society to deal with this situation. Because I still truly believe it can be fantastic. We just not if we keep things the way they are right now.
All right. Marshall, what's your take?
I 100% agree that we have to restructure the economy, and it has to spread all this robotic wealth out to all of us in a fair and reasonable and not insane way like it's doing right now. Another group of people that's going to lose their jobs real quick if we can get our act together is the whole health insurance industry, because that has nothing to do with robots either. That has to do with policy. If you just change the policy and say universal health care, we don't need insurance companies anymore, and they employ a lot of people and suck a lot of money out of the economy.
And is that why we don't have it?
There's a great article on how there's so much of the economy tied up in healthcare right now that we almost can't afford to dismantle it and go single payer or universal or whatever you want to call it, like every other developed country. We can't, because it'll destroy a huge number of jobs as we make that transition.
In his farewell speech, President Obama warned the next wave of economic dislocations won't come from overseas. It will come from the relentless pace of automation that makes a lot of good middle-class jobs obsolete. And a lot of people saw that as a reaction to his successor's promise to bring back jobs and make America great again, as it was during the height of America's manufacturing boom in the 20th century. But you agree with Obama, the two of you. So why are we refusing to listen? Is it because we're just afraid of what's coming down the track?
Look at Trump's cabinet. It's like it's a bunch – and look at Trump. It's a whole bunch of billionaires. They are in a fantastic place to extract money out of the economy into their own pockets, and they are not going to do anything to change that dynamic. They love being able to extract money from the economy. Like, look at what happened with the health care bill as it went through. It was like, well, let's give the rich a tax cut and take health care away from 24 million people who aren't rich. And that is the dynamic that is governing the whole country, possibly most of the world right now. But, and as long as that's in place, we're stuck.
But wait. On the one hand, President Trump says he's going to bring these manufacturing jobs back. And in fact, a lot of them are not going to come back, because once you're replaced by a robot, that's it, because you don't have to pay the robot. The robot never calls in sick. The robot doesn't have, days where they're depressed and so they're working slower. They don't call it, you know, they don't take vacation. They don't require benefits. So when you replace somebody with a robot, that's done. Those jobs aren't coming back. So we know that, and it's in the interest of business owners, is it not, to replace us all with automation as fast as possible? I was going to say fast as humanly possible, but that seems like an oxymoron in this case.
That's how we become as irrelevant as cockroaches.
Yes.
Right there, is because it makes a lot more sense to have a 24/7 automated truck driving down the highway and never having accidents than to put a truck driver who needs sleep and sick leave and everything else.
But it's one thing to replace blue-collar workers because they're on the factory floor. They're out in the field driving trucks or checking wires or whatever they do in their line of work. They're not sitting next to the boss or on the floor below the boss who runs the place. They don't have access to the boss. These white-collar workers do. They see him in the hallway. Maybe they work down the hall. Maybe they eat in the dining room at the office with him. Are they going to have more sway over being displaced by automation because of their proximity to the head guy, or is it going to happen anyway?
Only to the extent that they're executives. Like, the white-collar worker who's not at the, you know, million-dollar executive level, those folks will be protected because they're writing the rules and they run the government and so on. But any normal, like, I'm a white-collar worker. I teach at a university. And if you look at what's happened to universities over the last 20 or 30 years, the white-collar worker in universities, if not an administrator, has been decimated. The faculty has really taken a hit because they're replaceable. They can either be replaced with adjuncts or they can be replaced with videotape. You know, distance education is the proper word for it. So just videotape one lecture and play it over and over again.
Exactly. So why do you need administrators in that world? Because if you're just playing tapes back or you're putting all your classes online and once they're designed, they're there in perpetuity, what do you need administrators for?
Well, let me give one example in that context, which I think is very fitting. Just to put this in context, think about so definitely, even going forward, these new machines or these automated things will create some other jobs, not as, you know, not enough to like offset the jobs that go away. But so just one example is, for example, ATM machines. When ATM machines came around, just to make this concrete, what did they do? They replaced one task. The task was reading a check, typing that into some, or writing it into some ledger, and so on and so on. Now a machine would just take a photo and digitally process it. What happened is a human, and that's one thing that, you know, Marshall is talking about a lot, you know, vision is one of those things that's still pretty bad, or it's one of the weak spots at the moment still in machines. You know, they can't see if you have sloppy handwriting or whatever, you know, so that caused a lot of problems where somebody had to double check. So the number of double checkers, so to speak, in banks went up a lot, but we got rid of the tellers, right? So even in the scenario that we were just talking about where, say, an entire university is just run by lectures, well, for one, somebody has to record the lectures in the first place and perhaps update them. Well, maybe you can automate that too eventually, right? But, you know, somebody has to decide on what the curriculum needs to be. Well, maybe a computer can do that in the future. So, like, in the long haul, I agree. There could be potentially a scenario where everything is done automatically, fine. But it's going to take a while until we get to that state. But in the meantime, I fully agree that there's going to be fewer and fewer people who have any sort of, like, useful input into this whole system. And it may be things like double-checking or whatever at first, and then that will get weeded out, too, when machines become good enough at double-checking themselves.
And yet you still say, Dr. Gagel, it is not immediately obvious why this trend should be bad for society.
Well, no, because somebody owns the robot, and somebody owns what the robot produces.
How many owners of robots will there be? I mean, one of
that
you...
That is the question.
Yes. Well,
that is exactly the question, right? Like, imagine there's a world where everything is done by a robot. Somebody owns the robot. Now, if each of us own our private robot that does everything we want, kind of like Aladdin's lamp, we just say, this is what I want, and the robot brings it, fantastic. If there's one guy out there who owns all the robot, that guy's basically king and everybody else is miserable.
And which is the more likely scenario?
Well, the more likely scenario, if we keep society organized the way it is right now, there's going to be one guy who's king. And I think that is the big societal problem. How do we shape this transition in a way that we don't end up with one guy king who owns all the robots and everybody else is miserable?
Well, given
I think that is the big challenge.
Well, given the forces at work in the world today where people with big money seem to control everything, or certainly they certainly have a great deal of influence, and I'm not saying it's absolutely unfounded, but they have a great deal of influence. So if it's in their best interest to shape the world where they are the sole owners of the robots that produce everything, How could we ever gravitate toward a world in which everybody has a robot that does something that's of value?
I mean, I really think that solutions like now, while we still have democracies where people have something to say that are not, you know, the king, to stick with this analogy here, one policy that's been around for a long time that could very much help us go in that direction is, for example, something like a guaranteed basic income. And I know some listeners out there are going to cringe right now and say, oh, my God, he's talking about Karl Marx here or Vladimir Lenin or something like that. But it might come to your surprise that gentlemen like Friedrich Hayek or President Richard Nixon, as well as Milton Friedman, have advocated exactly that solution. And the reason, and I think that is one way to at least, even if we think in the end we need everybody to kind of take an ownership claim in the companies that own the robots, well, that way at least everybody has some income to start doing that investment.
All right, let's
being solely reliant on your labor, which
let's back up. Let's back up, because this is this robots having. I don't care who owns the robot, whether we all have a robot that does something, or whether most robots are going to be run by big industrialists, and so there'll be one or two or five guys or 10 guys who own everything and own all the robots that make everything. How do we buy the products if we're all out of work? If none of us have a job, how do we buy what these robots make that are owned by these overlords, these human overlords? How does that work?
Well, I mean, in
two
that
things.
Society, if you have the overlords in that society and you need to buy something, right? So if we're in a society where everybody has their own robot, you don't need to buy anything. The robot just makes it for you. Buying isn't a thing anymore, right? But if we're in a society where you know, a handful of people own, so to speak, the robots and everybody else doesn't, sure, then the people who don't need to buy something from the robot owners.
Marshall?
One way to...
Marshall? Do you want to chime
in on two it? Thoughts. One is, last fall, Oxfam did a study and announced that 8 people on the planet own as much wealth as the bottom half of the planet. So 8 people own as much as 3.6 billion people. And then last week it was announced that that number had gone down to 6. Now 6 people own as much as the lower 3.6 billion people. So that's the concentration of wealth at work. That's why it's quite likely that all the robots will be owned by a few. And then the second thing is that the whole idea of the economy as it's structured today is bad with robots coming, and it has to be redesigned. And like I said earlier, you can come to marshallbrain.com, and there's a free book online that talks about how you would redo the economy to make it possible to.
But what's the likelihood of that happening, given the fact that those who are already ahead in the economy, it's in their best interests to stay there?
Great. And so the context of the book I'm writing is the Mars colony that Elon Musk announced in September, with 1 million people moving to Mars, make that economy work the right way.
Hmm. The Star Trek economy, essentially, is what we're talking about here, I think.
It's better than that.
Okay, Marshall, well, we'll find out in a second. We have to take a break. Marshall Brain is here, Director of Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University, author of The Second Intelligent Species and HowStuffWorks.com, and Dr. Paul Gagel from UNC Charlotte. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Fresh Market, celebrating 35 years of fresh foods with in-store anniversary events throughout the month of April. Details at thefreshmarket.com. And Seagrove Potters, presenting Celebration of Spring April 22nd and 23rd. Over 65 shops offering demonstrations and events through the weekend. Details at discoverseagrove.com. The shocking video of a passenger bloodied and dragged off an overbooked United Airlines flight lit up social media this week. Everybody is asking, what rights do airline passengers have? They'll get to the bottom of that on Point this morning. Jane Clayson is in for Tom Ashbrook, and that starts in about 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation about the future of work in an automated world, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter @CharlotteTalks. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Flashes of light on the deck of a U.S. warship as it launches Tomahawk missiles at Syria into the darkness overnight.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
This announcement was hardly a big thumbs up for the law signed by Governor Roy Cooper last Thursday. In a statement, the NCAA wrote,
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about automation, and we're talking about work in an automated world, which is right around the corner, according to Marshall Brain and Dr. Paul Gagel. Marshall Brain is director of the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University. Dr. Paul Gagel, associate professor of economics and public policy at UNC Charlotte and a visiting professor at Duke University. And if you think this is just all Isaac Asimov, pie in the sky, Star Trek, think of what you would have thought about today's world in 1900. It would have been unimaginable.
Yep.
You couldn't even explain Twitter right now to somebody from that world. So how can we possibly not believe that this is coming down the pike? And you mentioned this colony on Mars and setting up a new economy on Mars that would help solve this problem. But really, a million people on Mars, isn't that like 300 years away? And do people want to go to Mars? And why would that economy, Marshall Brain, be better than the Star Trek economy, where you just say, computer, hot fudge sundae, and you have one?
That would be fantastic. Jetsons comes to mind, too. Like, let's not leave them out. So in September, Elon Musk got on stage, and he announced that a million people are going to be living on Mars, not an exact timeline, but in decades.
Yeah.
He proposed the rockets, the launch system, the refueling system, the capsules. 100 people at a time are going to Mars, according to Elon Musk, at a reasonable price. And so you get a million people on Mars, and then the question you ask is, are you going to take what's on Earth today, the economic system on Earth today, and are you going to just send that off to Mars with all the slums and the hunger and the poverty? Like, in America, we don't see a lot of this, but the majority of people on the planet are not having a great time when they get born. They're, you know, like a billion people live in just deplorable slums. So are we going to just export that to Mars, or are we going to come up with something better? And as soon as you ask that question and think, wow, we really should come up with something better on Mars, we should have a great economy on Mars that everybody prospers under, then you think, what would that be like? And then you immediately reflect back and say, like, if we could do that on Mars, well, why don't we just do it on Earth? Why don't we make Earth as cool as we think Mars will be and do it now? And that's how you get into the whole thought experiment of how to change the economy on Earth to benefit everybody.
You, Paul Gagel, mentioned universal basic income a minute ago, and one European nation, I think it was in Scandinavia, flirted with it already, and they voted it down. They decided against it. A universal basic income would mean that everybody, every citizen, would get a check from the government for whatever the amount may be every year. And maybe in an economy where absolutely nobody works, that may be necessary. But where does that money come from in that world? Because who would have money to pay taxes? It is taxes that fund Social Security and Medicare and the benefits that we get now. So if we don't have jobs that are putting money into that, how does the money come out?
From the owners of the capital. Right? I mean, somebody owns the robot. If there is an owner of the, unless we're in the doomsday scenario where the, you know, robots own themselves, then I don't know. But there's going to be some person or a group of people who are entitled to whatever the robots do. That's the income. That's what you use to distribute.
So you're saying the government would highly tax the producers, the owners of the producers.
It has to tax the only people who have any income. If there's supposed to be any tax system, somebody has to have some income.
But we have a tradition in this country of cutting taxes on the wealthy. These would be the wealthiest people in the history of human history. So are they likely to stand for that? Or wouldn't they be more powerful than the government?
Will they even be a government? That's a good question, right? I mean, and that's why this is so... Likely there wouldn't. I mean, the government would be called the king, and we've had that before, and we knew how that went for most people, right? So that's definitely a direction we're headed toward, and I agree with Marshall on that, and that we're headed toward that, given the current distribution of wealth, which is extremely concentrated.
What is your timeline for that? What do you think? When will this world begin to be noticeable to us?
Personally, I mean, the direction has already started. I mean, as Marshall just quoted, I mean, a handful of people own the vast majority of all the income we have. Frankly, I have no specific horizon to think about. I mean, there's so much uncertainty.
So when you
I think Marshall is much more, you know, optimistic about his forecasts. I would argue that I have no idea how long this will take, but I would say we should think very carefully about this sooner rather than later.
So, when you talk about ownership of robots, what comes to mind immediately is that somebody buys a robot, they own it. The robot makes things that people want, and people will buy those things. But is it going to be that way? Or is there a way that we can insert ourselves into ownership positions? Maybe not all of us is going to need to buy a personal robot that we have in our house or our garage, but we buy shares in a company that owns a robot. Is that how it's going to work if we want to distribute the wealth?
I mean, that's how it would work today, except only a hand, you know. The ability to do that is relatively limited already today, right? Because you need some income to be able to buy those shares. And a lot of people have just barely enough income to buy what they need to survive, and they have no extra to start investing in shares of companies. But in principle, that would be one way to do it. And this is one way where, for example, something like a guaranteed basic income can help. Or even if you do lose, you know, your job permanently, you at least, for a little while, you have some income. If you live hand to mouth and your job is gone forever, you are in big trouble.
We often,
and that's what's happening to a lot of people.
Science fiction has done this to us. I think many people have looked at some of these things that might be coming down the road as a doomsday scenario. But then you have to think that our lives are appreciably better than our ancestors' lives are today, because of machines. They didn't have vacuum cleaners. They didn't have dishwashers. They didn't have washers and dryers that did our clothes. They took the clothes down to the river and banged them on rocks for hours on end. Could it be that this will make the world better for the average person, these new machines? Marshall.
It could be. It could be that it makes the world better, but only if we change the economic system so that everybody gets to benefit. Like, let's just take Nike. There's a company that uses people to do stuff. They use people to make shoes. And so the CEO of Nike makes something like $15 million a year, and just an astronomical, ridiculous amount of money. And meanwhile, the 500,000 people who are making the shoes are making like a dollar an hour, mm-hmm. which means they make like $2,000 a year. That is likely where the future is going. And so, yes.
But Henry Ford,
for a lot of us.
But Henry Ford knew that he had to pay enough so that the people building the Model T could buy the car. These people making these Nikes can't afford to buy those shoes. That's not sustainable.
Yes, you'd think that, but Look at the health care plan that the Republicans tried to ram down the country's throat just a month or two ago. That was undeniably terrible for millions and millions of people in this country. And yet that was on the table with the president's support and a whole party that owns Congress right now, their support. Mm. And it collapsed. Why? Because it didn't go far enough to screw people. That's why it collapsed. That's unbelievable.
I want to share with you some comments that have come in while we've been talking from listeners. Tim on Twitter, robots don't need money or products. So if we eliminate that human spending, then do we need the product a robot is making? In other words, if there is no money to buy the products, do we need the products?
Yes, we need the product because we need to eat something.
But if we can't buy it, will we be given it? How will we get it?
Right. But, well, that's how ownership claims work, right? I mean, if you own the robot, you get the product it makes.
Well, yeah, right? But we're not going to all own these. It would be like owning a giant agricultural, what do you call those big farms, those mechanized farms? Like the people, you'd be the person that owns all the equipment on that farm. You'd get all the food. No one else would get any food.
That's why you have to rethink the economy. And right now, we're in a transition. So we have to take what's happening in the transition and design an economy that understands the transition that's happening and makes it work for everyone, not just for a few. So that straight up is what I'm writing about.
All right. So Will on Facebook is looking for the silver lining. He says his automation takes over. You still need engineers to assemble, maintain, and implement the automation. Those jobs are important and plentiful. Stop fearing change. But one of you, and maybe both of you, predict that robots will soon be building themselves and fixing themselves. Right?
I'm an engineer.
That's definitely a possibility. Go ahead.
I'm an engineer. There are at most 2 million engineers in the United States. And it's true that engineers might hold on for a while, but it is inevitable that programmers and engineers and all those folks are going to get automated out just like everybody else.
Hmm. Peter in Monroe, as automation increases productivity and continues to concentrate those efficiencies to investors, wouldn't this just continue to the concentration of benefits to companies and investors? Wouldn't the 1% support that? What percentage trend in increased efficiency should we expect? Dr. Gagel.
I don't know what increase we should expect. I mean, how much efficiency should increase. I don't know, but what we do know is that, it has increased in the past just by looking at we're making more with the same number of inputs. What exact number should we expect? I don't know. I do not want to make that prediction.
Okay. Lewis and Charlotte with a prediction. The current generation of trucks and passenger aircraft are loaded by hand. Even the so-called container-loaded aircraft, such as an Airbus 330, have containers loaded by humans on the ground. There will be a golden age of manufacturing and design while everything is redesigned to be more easily machine-managed. The result will be that we will start to value things which require imagination and creativity. We will produce and consume entertainment as our highest social value, and art and meaning will be what we treasure. Do you agree with that?
It's definitely possible, and that would be a fantastic world.
So we'd just be fat, dumb, and happy watching TV all day?
I mean, in an ideal... This is a world that's possible, but I agree with Marshall. It all depends on how we organize, how we split the pie, and the way we do that right now. I frankly have to agree with Marshall. I don't see that happening the way society is organized right now. But I do agree with the Facebook or the tweet or whatever it was that absolutely there will for sure, at the very least along the transition, be many new and other jobs that we need to help that transition, like the reader or the listener suggested. But it is still not unthinkable. I don't think this is going to happen soon that all jobs are gone, but it's not unthinkable that at one point we don't need jobs in a strict sense, and our job might be to, discuss and enjoy art. And
so what do you tell children today? What should we be telling children today, fifth graders, sixth graders, about they're going to inherit this robot world or this automated world in some way if your predictions hold true, and apparently they're going to. How do you prepare them? What should they be doing to get ready?
Well, if you ask
me, I have four teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Okay. I have four teenagers. Two thoughts that we talk about all the time are engineering and programming and so on is fairly it'll be a while before that gets automated out. And right now, if you have a degree in engineering coming out of NC State, you're in great shape because there is a big job market for engineers. So that is one path. The other path is start your own business and become the executive class yourself, or find a way to get into the executive class yourself, because those people are writing the checks. And as long as they're writing the checks, they'll write checks for themselves, and that's where you need to be. That the easiest way to do that is to start your own company.
Dr. Gagel?
And I would agree with those statements, but I would add one more. Focusing, you singled out engineering, right? The thing that's why engineering is so in high demand these days is because what is it that engineers do? They know how to figure out tough problems that nobody has solved before, and that's really what matters for the future. And so in line with your thought of encouraging entrepreneurship and so on, I mean, what's the most important thing is to be flexible, to learn how to teach yourself things that you didn't know before, because things are going to change, and most likely at a more rapid pace than they have in the past, and we don't know what those changes will be. We don't know what the next iPhone will be and what it's going to do to our society. But you want to do as much as you can to be ready for that. And, you know, and one trait of engineers is that they're exactly good at that, figuring out new things when the situation changes. And that, I think, is the most important skill to learn.
Will we look back in 50 years and see today and what happened in this last election cycle, the unrest and the dissatisfaction that we've felt in this election cycle, as the beginnings of this shift in work and the economy?
I hope so.
Trump was elected in a democracy, and the people who elected him are the ones who are going to get hurt the most. That's amazing. I'm not sure how to change that.
Marshall Brain is director of Engineering and Entrepreneurs Program at NC State University, author of The Second Intelligent Species, How Humans Will Become as Irrelevant as Cockroaches, and originator of the HowStuffWorks.com website. Dr. Paul Gagel, Assistant Professor of Economics and Public Policy at UNC Charlotte. Thank you both for the hour, I think.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.